I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour is Ronald White. His latest book is American Ulysses, A Life of Ulysses S. Grant, beautifully written, and gives us the whole life trajectory from when he was very young to his years as president and how he left the presidency and his relationship with Mark Twain, friendship, his memoirs, and his place in American history. We tend to overlook this president, but he was a fascinating human being and did some very substantial things when he was in the White House. Second term was plagued by some scandal. We will talk about that. And that, according to Southern writers writing about the Civil War, has probably cast a shadow over his presidency and perhaps his time during the Civil War as well. Well, we'll find out a whole lot about him. Ronald White is actually a Lincoln scholar. He's the author of 3 best-selling books on Abraham Lincoln, including A. Lincoln, his most recent. He has lectured on Lincoln at hundreds of universities. He's lectured at Gettysburg and at the White House. He's a fellow at the Huntington Library and a senior fellow of the Trinity Forum of Washington, D.C. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Ronald White, hello. Thank you ever so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Kathleen. I'm looking forward to being with you and your listeners.
Yeah, I am too. And what a fine book you have read. You're a great writer. And isn't he a fascinating man? I know a little bit about him, and you've done a lot of Lincoln books. Obviously, Grant figured into those books as well. But even you say early in the book, didn't know as much about him as you would like to, and thus the book.
That's correct. Obviously, he was central in my Lincoln biography because he was the general who won the Civil War. But about a year and a half into my work on Grant, I had to make a personal confession. I didn't really know the man. I knew what he did, the general, but I didn't know who he was and who he became after the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly know him now, and I love the fact, and I love this little vignette at the very beginning of the book where you talk about Ulysses Grant, who's with his son, and he's coming to Washington because he's going to be general of the Union forces, and they don't know who he is at the Willard Hotel, do they?
They don't, and he doesn't say, "Don't you know who I am?" They say, "Well, we can find a tiny little room on the 6th floor," and he very softly says, "That will be okay."
Yeah, and then they realize who he is, and there's a letter from the president that he should join him for dinner. Oh, yes. Mr. Grant, I'm sorry.
Well, and I think I didn't intend it to be this way, but I think it's a contrast to so many of the so-called big personalities we have today, whether it's politics,
yes,
or entertainment or sports. Grant is a very self-effacing person. Humility is a part of who he is, and I think that's what endears him to people.
Absolutely. You write a lot about his early years, and you include a quote on one of the chapters that Grant said, and I think that this is instructive about him as well. Grant did a lot of reading, read a lot of novels, but you say that he said, "I read but few lives of great men because biographers do not, as a rule, tell enough about the formative period of life. What I want to know is what a man did as a boy." Is that true?
I think that's, today biographies are popular and publishers want to bring them out. But even as I read them, I find lots of them skip very quickly over the story of the young boy or the young girl to the person who becomes the great leader.
Yes.
And I think if we think about our own lives, we know that the ages 16, 18, 20, 22 are so formative in who we become. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to take the time, I hope my readers would give me the time, to tell the story of the young Grant.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about the young Grant, because I found the picture that he drew of, he was quite a drawer as well. And this love of horses, being able to train them, runs all throughout his life. Started very young with him, didn't it?
It did. You know, we don't live in that culture today, but people in his day did. And so the fact that we would maybe even call him a horse whisperer or a horse...
Yes.
People brought horses to him by the time he was 9 years of age, and he didn't strong-arm these horses. He gentled them. And this, I think, says so much about him as a human being.
Mm-hmm. What does it say about him as a human being?
Well, that he is a gentle person. There was an episode during the war where a man was whipping a horse, and Grant, who always wore a private's uniform, the man did not recognize that this was General Grant, who then had him kind of court-martialed, so to speak, and the man comes and apologizes and says, well, if I know who it was, I wouldn't have done this to you. And Grant says, well, you don't have to apologize to me. I can defend myself, but the horse cannot. And I thought, what a remarkable story.
Yes, it is. And the picture is lovely. I love the pictures. And the other one of a Native American, I think, and a dog. And
yes.
He was quite a drawer.
He was quite a drawer. And this, again, is, I think, part of the story of Grant. We don't know. He finished only 21st out of 39 in his classes at West Point. So we think that he was simply an average student. But in his memoirs, he said, I must apologize. I spent most of my time reading novels. Well, I spent a week at West Point trying to understand that, and the novels were sort of second-class literature in his day. As a strict Methodist, they were kind of scurrilous novels, too. But his novels and his artwork tell me a person of great intellectual curiosity, and this is what we need to know about him.
Mm-hmm. And also cultural curiosity. I didn't know very much, to tell you the truth, about the Mexican War, and I loved your chapters there because I learned a whole lot. But he was also, and I guess, a lifelong interest in Mexico, too. Mexico, other cultures. He liked to look around and take it all in.
Yes, I make the point that when he crossed the boundary of the Rio Grande into Mexico, why, actually, he probably crossed three boundaries. Most of the soldiers were not much interested. In fact, they were pretty depreciating in their comments and their own letters about Mexicans. But he, first of all, wanted to understand another culture. Then it forced him to look back upon his own culture. And finally, it forced him to think more definitively about himself. And so I think this is what can happen when we travel. And this is what happened to Grant and why he loved travel. Travel was so educational for him.
Mm-hmm. He was reading The Life of George Washington. I guess a lot of young people read that, but he was only 7 years old.
Right. Well, and it was written, I didn't know this again until I delved into it more. It was written, the famous biography was by a man named Parson Weems. Well, Parson meant he was an Episcopal minister, and the point of the biography was not simply, again, what Washington did, but the moral lessons that Washington could therefore transmit to his young readers, and Grant picked up the moral lessons from Washington.
Mm-hmm. Did he run into, let's just go to the Mexican War here for a moment, because I wanted to ask you about this. He has said, Grant said of the Mexican War, I'm always asked of my country what I think of that invasion. I know the struggle with my conscience during the Mexican War, and I don't think there was ever a more wicked war. I thought so at the time when I was a youngster, only I had not the moral courage enough to resign. I'm trying to get inside this man's head who was fighting and very gallantly in the Mexican War and effectively, and yet he was totally opposed to it.
Yes, this is something he calls it our most wicked war, the very idea that a large country would attack a small country. And so he saw the Mexican soldiers ill-equipped. They fought bravely, but they had no chance against the American army. And so he goes back very honestly, very transparently, sort of saying, you know, I want you to know that I struggled with this, and I didn't do the right thing. I mean, how many people write a memoir and say, I didn't do the right thing, I should have resigned, but I didn't have the moral courage to do so? And that's characteristic of his memoirs. He tells us of his weaknesses, mm-hmm. not simply his strengths.
Mm-hmm. Another person who figures prominently and probably has not had that prominent a place in other biographies about Grant is his wife. And this is an interesting story, too, because of her family's background and Ulysses Grant's family's background.
Yes, Julia, I feel, had been minimized or marginalized in previous biographies. She was the sister of his roommate his senior year at West Point. So when he graduated, was stationed at Jefferson Barracks in St. Louis, his roommate said, you need to visit my family. They're very hospitable to young soldiers. And when he visited the family, he met Julia and fell in love with her. Well, he didn't realize at the time he had to court her father as much as her, and so it took them 4 years to get married. But then when the wedding finally came after the Civil War, his parents wouldn't attend because his parents were strongly anti-slavery. Her father was strongly pro-slavery. Her father gave her four slaves.
Goodness.
As a wedding gift. And I don't think these two young people, as maybe most young people, realize that it wasn't just the two of them. He had to figure out how to navigate in her father-in-law's household. What are you going to do with this man who was so pro-slavery?
Mm-hmm. And he freed one of those slaves, didn't he? What happened to the others?
The others were really her slaves. They were female slaves who worked for her, but there was one male slave who worked on the farm. And if our listeners are fortunate enough, and I commend it, the Park Service has the U.S. Grant Historic Site. It's the house where she lived in the country, now near St. Louis. The film begins with the story of him freeing, the film there begins with the story of freeing William in 1859. He doesn't tell us why. This is typical Grant, but Grant was really hard up for money at that time. He could have received $1,000 for an able-bodied young male slave. He just simply signed the manumission papers. He could no longer do this, and he let the man free.
Hmm. And he did have money problems, it appeared, for quite some time. He went to California at one point, and you say that he kind of caught the money bug there because it wasn't. Yeah, what was that all about?
Well, he was stationed out in first Oregon and then California. The soldiers were there to protect the settlers coming west. And he heard about all these different ways to make money. He had seen some of this when he initially docked in San Francisco. So he tried several schemes, all of which failed. And I think he was pretty naive, not very aware of what was going on. And so this, again, is part of the failures in his early adult life.
Mm-hmm. When the Civil War started, he has said this in his memoir, "It made my blood run cold to hear friends of mine deliberately discuss the dissolution of the Union as though it were a tariff bill. I could not endure it. I wanted to leave the country if disunion was accomplished."
Yes, he had this wonderful, deep belief in the Union. Not at first a belief in a Union that would free the slaves. That's not where he was at the beginning, but he believed in the Union, and that's why he wanted to serve his country. And he writes both his father and his father-in-law in the first days of the war, telling both of them it was the time either now to become patriots or tyrants, mm-hmm. and he was taking his side, and he was going to play his role, never ever realizing what that role would end up being.
And when you think about it, it's fairly amazing. Here's a guy who resigned his position in California, came home, was working with his dad, had this stint in the Mexican War and had been other places, but all of a sudden becomes this huge figure in helping to win the war for the Union. And he was working with his dad in a shop in Galena, wasn't he, when all of this started?
Well, yes, he came back from he resigned in 1854, his post in California. Came back, lived on his father-in-law's property, built a home that he sardonically called Hardscrabble, tried to be a farmer, tried to do various things, all of which didn't go well. And finally in 1860, in a really kind of a humiliation, accepted a position in his father's leather goods store in Galena, Illinois, in far northwestern Illinois, underneath his younger brother. And there began to pay off some debts from Missouri, and thought, well, I'll just settle into this life. And then the war broke out.
Mm-hmm. So how was he noticed?
Well, he wasn't really very noticed, but when the war broke out, they had a public meeting, and he was the only West Point graduate in this town of just a few thousand people. And so they called upon him to help organize a volunteer regiment to instruct them as to what to do. And suddenly this sort of relatively unknown person became a well-known person in Galena, but he didn't want to certainly serve as a volunteer or even in his previous rank. He wanted something that was befitting of his experience, and so he searched for quite a while until he finally found a role, and then he rose quite rapidly.
Mm-hmm. And he had learned all of that along the way. I go back to the Mexican War and all that he learned. It was a very important chapter in his life because he learned how to fight, he learned how to organize. He learned how to be in the background as well. He was very effective at the art, if you can call it that, of war.
Well, and going back to your term earlier of observer, he observed leadership in both the good and bad leadership in the war. He watched people followed their lead, and I suggest that he had latent qualities of leadership which had not ever been fully expressed. They were expressed early when he had to lead people across the terrible Isthmus of Panama on the way to his destination of California and Oregon. He watched in the Mexican War, didn't really have a major role in it, but now when he had an opportunity, these latent qualities came to the fore. We must remember that the largest army that had ever been put together in the United States was only 14,000 people in the war with Mexico. Now suddenly Grant was commanding armies of more than 100,000 people. People were not prepared for this, even at West Point. You couldn't say, well, this person did well at West Point, therefore. But Grant knew how to coordinate large armies. This was one of his many gifts.
Mm-hmm. And where did he learn that?
It's hard to know exactly how he learned this. I think he learned it sort of almost, we would say, on the fly. He learned it by careful observing of the men under him, discerning who were and who were not good leaders. He had a terrific capacity for what we would call topography, for the lay of the land. He loved to study maps, and so he had a sense of how to conduct a battle. These battlefields were much larger than had ever been conducted, say, in Europe. And so how to conduct large armies over large battlefields took someone who had particular kind of gifts.
And may go back in some measure, small may it be, but maybe it was larger, to the classes he took at West Point in drawing maps, right? Drawing topography.
I think that's true. I think it's absolutely true. So he studied maps, and he could literally see the land. When he finally took over and Lincoln gave him command of all the Union armies, he had to make a yet another invasion. There had been four failed ones into Virginia. Well, he'd never been in Virginia, but he studied the maps, and he understood the terrain. And this helped him lead that large, large army.
Mm-hmm. Why did Lincoln choose him, and how did he go about choosing him?
Well, this is a fascinating story. Many people know that there were many failed Union generals.
Yes.
Probably most notoriously George McClellan. And the question I'm often asked by audience is, why did he stay with McClellan so long? Well, maybe the answer is the soldiers were still loyal to McClellan. But Lincoln had always wanted to meet his generals to size them up. Well, he couldn't meet Grant because Grant was way out west. But Grant had what Lincoln called pertinacity. We would use the word determination. He had this determination. I've had the privilege in the last few months of doing a couple of events, and we'll do one at West Point next month with General David Petraeus.
Oh, really?
And I've learned from General Petraeus, he ranks Grant as the greatest American general.
Hmm.
And he says, Grant has this remarkable determination. General Petraeus told me and our audiences that he read Grant in preparing for the surge in Iraq.
Really?
How difficult that surge was, how often there were setbacks, but he kept reminding his troops of Grant, that Grant had this determination. When Grant was stuck in the wilderness after the first couple of nights of the incursion into Virginia, a young reporter said, do you have any words for President Lincoln? And Grant, a man of few words, said to the young reporter, simply tell President Lincoln, there will be no turning back. There will be no turning back. So armies traditionally fought a few days, rested, refitted. Grant just kept pushing, knowing he had the advantage numerically over Lee, and if he kept pushing, someday, somehow down the road, Lee could not finally resist this kind of pertinacity or determination of Grant.
Mm, that's a good word. I'll have to incorporate that into my vocabulary
right.
In future years. Pertinacity. Thank goodness he wrote, and he did it, I guess, to make money. Let's jump to the end here for a moment. His memoir, which was highly acclaimed and still read by many presidents and many of us, right?
Yes. Well, it's interesting because Grant did not want to write his memoirs. He thought they were self-serving. They were settling scores. Do you know that during President Eisenhower's two terms as president, only one cabinet member ever wrote a memoir? Would you like to try to count how many were written during the 8 years of President Bush or the 8 years of President Obama? Right. Everybody's writing their memoirs.
Yes.
And they are often self-serving, settling scores. But then Grant contracted cancer and knew that he was dying. There were no presidential pensions. He had to find a way to have money to for Julia after his death. So he was offered $10,000, which is a lot of money, by the Century magazine to write his memoirs. But Mark Twain heard about this, and he rushed over to Grant's home. He'd always been a fan of Grant. They'd met before, and he said in Grant's typical way, $10,000, that's what you'd pay an unknown Comanche Indian to write his memoirs. Mm. And he persuaded Grant that he would publish his memoirs, and he would give him 70% of the net
proceeds. Oh, my gosh.
And so Twain became the great benefactor of Grant, and Grant set out to write what, as you suggested correctly, is the most memorable literary American memoir. It's just wonderful.
Yeah, and so he was in dire straits a lot, it seems, during his life. Because tell me more about the fraud thing that happened on Wall Street, and he lost all his money after he was president, I think, wasn't it?
After he was president, he took a remarkable 2.5-year world tour. He came back. There were no presidential pensions. His second son, Buck, went into partnership on Wall Street with supposedly a young and up-and-coming financier. What neither of them knew was the financier was a fraud. He was involved in a Ponzi scheme, and Grant gave his son all of his savings to invest in this firm, but he came home one day to discover it was totally gone. The partner was arrested, put in jail. Grant had $85 to his name.
Goodness.
And that's the background of why he decided he would accept the offer to write his memoirs.
Hmm. And a little side note, I believe that Julia and Lee's wife, Robert E. Lee's wife, became friends.
Well, Julia actually and Jefferson Davis.
Jefferson Davis, right. I'm sorry.
Right. This is another remarkable story. I mean, Jefferson Davis died, Grant died, and Julia was vacationing in a lovely resort on the Hudson River in New York, and she heard that Verena Davis, Jefferson Davis's wife, was also there. So she went and knocked on the door of Jefferson Davis's widow, introduced herself, and the two became very good friends.
Huh.
And people would see them driving down in a carriage Fifth Avenue in New York City. And so this kind of reconciliation, I mean, Grant was known for his wonderful offer of peace to Robert E. Lee, very magnanimous. But Julia did the same thing. She reached out to Verena Davis, and the two became friends.
Mm. We'll start taking phone calls. We're speaking with Ronald White this hour of the program. His book is American Ulysses, A Life of Ulysses S. Grant. Ronald has written a number of books, three actually, all bestsellers on Abraham Lincoln, including his most recent, A. Lincoln. He has lectured on Lincoln all over the country, at Gettysburg, at the White House, a fellow at the Huntington Library, senior fellow of the Trinity Forum of Washington, D.C. And we're going to go to your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to phone calls. Don in Madison. Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead, Don.
Thanks. I didn't hear my name.
Oh, okay.
Concerning Grant's character, I'd like to know what the author thinks of what seems to be good evidence that Grant was anti-Semitic.
Don, thank you. That's a very important question. The evidence for that is that in 1862, Grant became very concerned about the trading that was going on that was benefiting the Confederacy, and many of the traders were Jewish. So he offered in December an order number 11, banning Jews from trading.
Hmm.
Often not seen is that he was also quite upset at the very same time that his father, who was always trying to take advantage of Grant's position, had hired himself out to a Jewish company in Cincinnati and was actually there in the South trading in this effort. So Grant issued this order. Julia would later call it that obnoxious order. And when Lincoln heard about it, he immediately canceled the order. Now, if that was the end of the story, why, that would be just simply making Grant out to be anti-Semitic. But our finest American Jewish historian has written a wonderful new book, and his name's going to come to me shortly. But the title of the book is When Grant Expelled the Jews, Jonathan Sarna, S-A-R-N-A.
Okay.
And he tells the story that Grant learned from this experience, became extremely remorseful of it, and went on to appoint more Jews in his administration as president than any previous president. He also made it a point that when the first Jewish synagogue was erected in Washington, D.C., Grant went and spent 3 hours there as their guest. And so he changed through that experience. One of the things that I'm interested in as a biographer is, can people learn from their mistakes?
Mm-hmm.
And I think in this instance, Grant did.
Hmm. May I ask a follow-up?
Go ahead, Don.
Thank you. So two points then in what you were just describing. By the way, I think your book sounds fascinating. What effect do you think that had on Lincoln's opinion of him, if there's any evidence for that? And also, it was curious that he did that, forbidding trading with Jews, and regretted it, and that's the same thing that happened to him with the Mexican War. Am I correct?
That's an interesting point, Don. I'd never put those two together, that he regretted both of those things. Well, Lincoln also had been reached out by a number of Jewish people and was very sympathetic to the plight of Jews. We don't have any particular record as to what then Lincoln thought about Grant. Of course, Grant's change of heart would have been after Lincoln's assassination, so he wouldn't have been able to witness that. But what he thought about Grant at that point in time, he was disappointed in Grant, but that didn't disabuse his belief in Grant as the general that he wanted to finally promote to lead all the Union armies.
And you remind us in the book, and I'd like for you to talk more about each of these, as president, defended the rights of African Americans, battled against the Ku Klux Klan and voter suppression, and reimagined Indian policy.
Well, yes, I was surprised by all of this. As I say in the book, I think Grant's two terms as president have been so overshadowed by the scandals and admitted scandals in the second term that we fail to notice some of the very positive things that Grant did. In his first inaugural address, he suggested for the first time in American history, we need to deal seriously with the Indian question. We've treated the Indians immorally, and we must change that. This put him at odds with his own general friends, Sherman and Sheridan. But Grant believed that the problem was very much the settlers more than it was the Indians. So he called together the leaders of all the Christian churches very quickly after his inauguration to try to inaugurate a new Indian policy. Now, it was a great initiative, a great vision. It didn't finally produce what he wanted because the wars with the Indians came forward and the massacres of the Indians. That's one thing. More importantly and more lasting was his belief that the voting rights of African Americans, even though there were the Reconstruction Amendments, were being sabotaged by the violence of the Ku Klux Klan and other white leaguers. And so Grant stood up squarely. Even when the Ku Klux Klan were arrested, he discovered that in the local or state courts, they were never prosecuted. And so he was willing to use the power of the central government, both the government and the army, as a Republican president to try to solidify and defend the rights of African Americans. And I say in the book, he's the last president to do that for 90 years until we get to John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Baines Johnson. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, John, so much for your excellent questions.
Thank you, Don.
Tom in Green Bay. Hello, Tom. Tom, turn the radio down. While you're doing that, we will go to Robert outside Madison. Hi, Robert.
Good afternoon, Kathleen. I would like your guest to talk about Grant's relationship with Sherman. As far as slavery was concerned, Grant was vehemently opposed to slavery, and Sherman not so much, and how that affected their relationship, and also the drinking relationship between Sherman and Grant, and how that affected their relationship also.
Thank you, Robert, for your questions. Yes, I say in the biography that it's a remarkable relationship because these two men were in many ways so opposite. I mean, Grant was very quiet in temperament. Sherman was loud and spontaneous. Grant was slow to anger, did not use profanity. Sherman was quick to anger, had quite a volatile temper. And you're correct in saying that they had quite different views on slavery. And it seems to me that they never kind of finally engaged each other on this. Is it that their friendship was so deep and lasting that Grant was willing to kind of overlook this? As the war was going forward, the invitation was given both to Sherman and Grant to offer a word as to how the Southern states should be treated once the war was over. And Grant didn't answer it first, and then Sherman did, and he said, well, we shouldn't treat these states very magnanimously. They've done this, that, and the other. Remember, Sherman had once upon a time led an academy in Louisiana. But when Grant read Sherman's response, he wrote back and almost literally said, well, no, I don't agree with that. I think we ought to, and his thinking was much more in line with Lincoln, that we ought to treat the South magnanimously. That's the way to bring them back into the Union.
Didn't he stop? Wasn't there a 20-gun salute or something when they heard his meeting with Lee, and the word spread among the soldiers at Appomattox that there was the start of a salute and Grant stopped it?
That's exactly right.
It did happen.
Grant stopped the salute. He said, these who were once our enemy are now our brothers again. And so there would be no celebrating this victory. Grant understood again the deep sorrow and emotion that these Confederate soldiers must have had in their hearts when they had to finally turn in their weapons. Mm-hmm. In terms of the drinking issue, I say in the book that I think Grant did have a drinking issue early in his life, especially. It's hard to get all of that story. There are many people who said they were there presently when Grant did not drink. Again, I don't think this became an issue between Grant and Sherman. The more striking part to me is how they kept this friendship. Andrew Johnson, as president, tried to divide them, and Sherman would not allow them to be divided. Johnson wanted to sort of put Sherman in Grant's place, and Sherman would not hear of that.
Thanks so much, Robert, for your call. And let's try Tom again in Green Bay. Hi, Tom.
How about Dave in Green Bay?
Oh, Dave. All right, Dave. Sorry. Hi.
Hi. My question was about the influence of General Fremont into the military development of President Grant.
Thank you, Dave. That's a very good question. When Grant was at the very beginning of his military career, Fremont had been, as you know, posted to be the general in charge of the Union forces in the West. And Grant went in to meet with Fremont. He was struck, as were others, that Fremont seemed to surround himself in a very opulent way, lived in a beautiful home. He had sort of almost like we would call Swiss guards. This was very much against what Grant had seen and witnessed in the generals that he followed in Mexico. And so later on, Fremont wrote a letter really commending Grant. He saw in Grant a great leader, but as you know, Fremont wasn't in that position very long because he took a position about slavery, freeing the slaves, that Lincoln was not ready to take, and Fremont was removed from his command. So I don't think that Fremont really became a model for Grant in terms of military leadership.
When he, let's talk about the second 4 years, his second term in office as president, because I'm interested in all of this, and this is where we get bogged down with Grant. We tend to remember him when you hear about, oh, Grant, yeah, great, you know, won the Civil War for the Union, but scandalous administration. We have this vision of him, and maybe that's why people don't pay much attention to him, that he was up to no good when he was in the White House. Tell me about those scandals and the trust that he had in people he shouldn't have trusted.
Yes, there were at least six sort of major scandals in his second 4 years in office. And this, I found, one of the most puzzling parts of trying to discern who he was. Was it that Grant knew and just turned a blind eye? No, I don't think that's true. Did he not pay enough attention? We do know that in his generalship in the Army, he gave great authority and leeway to his division commanders or his corps commanders. He was not a micromanager, but he knew those men very carefully in the Civil War. He didn't know these men very well. A few he did, but many of them, you know, were appointed into his cabinet for this reason or the other, their own geography or their own special talent. There was one case, Orville Babcock, who had served with him in the Civil War, and Babcock surely was caught up in scandal, and this was a case where Grant simply could not believe it. And I think this is part of the reason that his reputation, certainly as president, has not been so high. It is rising. I participated this year in the Pew, in the C-SPAN survey of American presidents, the first one they've done in 10 years. And each of the three in the 21st century, each time Grant is rising in estimation in that presidential survey.
Hmm. And you say that he would have, had he run for a third term, he probably would have been elected. He was considered one of the three great American leaders.
That's right. Even though the scandals were there, people did not really fully blame him. They still admired him greatly. And what I discovered, again, to my surprise, was that in various medals and lithographs that were done, often they had three great leaders in the 19th century, Washington, Lincoln, and Grant. And in 1900, Theodore Roosevelt said of the greatest of the living, the mighty dead are the three, Washington, Lincoln, and Grant. And then he said, Roosevelt said this, of second rank were Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, and Andrew Jackson.
Oh, my.
Of second rank. So he put Jefferson below Grant in his estimation.
Hmm. Our number is 800-486-8655. Ulysses S. Grant, the president we're talking about this hour, with the author of American Ulysses, A Life of Ulysses S. Grant. Ronald White is our guest. He's a Lincoln scholar, actually, but he's now a Grant scholar as well. We have some lines open. Tom in Tomahawk. Hi.
Well, good afternoon. Love the program. I always thought Grant was kind of a failure. That's what I had thought I had heard in history. And thanks to Wisconsin Public Radio, they read his memoir on the radio at the noon hour reading, and I couldn't miss it. And I read I listened to the whole program.
Good for
I don't know if they read every memoir, every bit of the memoir. And then I became interested in him. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, there was another biography of him published, and I read that one. Unfortunately, I gave it to my brother-in-law, and I never gave it back, and I can't remember who it is. But somebody once asked me, who's your favorite president? I said, Grant.
Really?
And
good for you, Tom.
And my rebuff friends almost fell off their chairs. And then I went into all these things that your guest has noted about his belief in civil rights and Indian concerns about what was happening to the Indians and how he was essentially trapped by other people who prevented him from doing things. But anyway, that's all. Again, my thanks to Wisconsin Public Radio for reading his memoir and opening my eyes.
Thanks, Tom. That's a wonderful story. Happy to do that. It's good to read books and to talk about books and to talk about presidents. That's a great story. What did Lincoln, you're a Lincoln scholar as well. What about the relationship? And I have to read a Lincoln. I haven't read it yet. And I love Lincoln. Let me tell you, if you ask me who's the greatest, it's Abraham Lincoln. But I could read about him endlessly. So in my retirement, I'll be reading all of your books, Ronald, which is coming up soon. But what about the relationship between the two of them? Was it warm? Did Lincoln have complete faith in him? I know Ulysses Grant was involved in planning Lincoln's funeral as well. Were they close?
They were close. I would call it a mutual admiration society. When Grant came east in March of 1864 to take command of all the Union armies, they then met three different times in the White House during his leadership, came away with a terrific appreciation on that first battle in Virginia, when Grant was somewhat stymied at, we call it, the Battle of the Wilderness. Why, when Lincoln finally got the word from Grant, there will be no turning back, Lincoln turned to his aide, his young secretary, John Hay, and said, if any other general had been in charge of this army, we would have been on the other side, in other words, marching back towards Washington.
Oh, my.
And this is where he said it is Grant's pertinacity that he wins, that wins. And I think Lincoln, as a Western man, Grant as a Western man, they didn't stand on show. They weren't necessarily dressed up like some of the Eastern generals. They weren't puffed up with pride. Right. So there were a lot of similar characteristics between these two men, and I think they deeply admired each other.
What happened to his children? You talked about Buck being involved in this trading thing that went south. Well, he had four children. What happened to all of them?
Well, four children, three boys. The older boy went on to become a general, served in administration, became quite successful. Buck and the younger boy, Jesse, both actually moved finally to San Diego. And the U.S. Grant Hotel is there today. It's a beautiful hotel. It's now owned by the American Indians.
Oh, my gosh.
But they became quite successful in real estate in San Diego. Nellie, the daughter, who was the apple of Grant's eye, she did not have the formal education of her three brothers, which, again, sometimes I think unfairly has minimalized her. But she had tutors. She was bright. Grant at one point wrote, he said, Nellie can write better than the three boys. She was a good writer. Mm. But sadly, she married a young Englishman who was not a good person. Mm. And finally, she divorced him and moved back to the United States. And after her father's death, moved back to live with her mother.
Oh. And Julia lived how much longer after Grant's death?
Julia lived, Grant died in 1885. Julia lived all the way till 1902.
Oh.
And she lived in their home in New York, but then finally moved back to Washington, D.C. and resumed part of her role that she was so good at when she was the wife of the president in terms of putting on social events. She did write her own memoirs, which were not of the same caliber of his, and they were not published in her lifetime, but they were published by the Grant Papers in 1975 or 76. Mm-hmm. And they are revealing. They are somewhat like memoirs, unfortunately, tend to be. They're kind of defending her husband. But they do give us some characteristics of him, some glimpses of him that are important to understand.
Mm. And they were, is this right that Ulysses and Julia were supposed to be at the Ford Theater with the Lincolns?
They were. Here's another one of those historical questions. Why were they not?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had accepted an invitation. Grant had invited them to be there. And then she wrote a note to Ulysses early that day and said, we need to leave. Why did she write the note? Well, one story is that she did not get along well with Mary Lincoln, and that was true. Mary Lincoln was suspicious of all kinds of women, and she sort of told Julia, well, I know you have your eye on the White House. This was during the Civil War, and Julia did not appreciate that.
Hmm.
But Julia also felt that she was being what's the word we would use today? Sort of someone was following her at lunch, was following her in her stagecoach. This made her nervous. But I think the real reason was she simply said, we need to see our children. We haven't seen them for so long.
Mm-hmm.
They lived in a town right outside of Philadelphia, and so she persuaded Ulysses to take the train that evening. And when the train arrived in Philadelphia, a messenger came up to him and gave him the news that the president had been assassinated.
Oh, can't imagine that moment for him. Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. Ulysses Grant, the focus of the hour's conversation with the author of American Ulysses, A Life of Ulysses S. Grant. Ronald White is our guest. And here's how you reach us in the remaining minutes. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. All right, back to phone calls. Keith in Beaver Dam, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if Mr. White could expand on two comments I'd like to make. I read the book, Grant's Memoirs. In there, he was out on a search, and he had actually got shot. When he came back, he had bullet holes in his clothes. And also, in an agricultural book from the 1870s, I want to say, I read that he did visit Wisconsin, and one of his speeches, he was addressing the soldiers who just loved him, and he was so humble and thanking wives and daughters and other family members that had their lost loved ones or had the men had served in the Civil War. So I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Well, let me start, thank you very much, Keith, with the second part of your comment. Yes, interestingly, in 1880, he returned from his triumphant world tour. He took it as a private citizen, but he quickly was mobbed as kind of the ambassador of American values. And this word got back to America, and even those who maybe had been worried about his scandals of his second term said, my goodness, maybe we should think of this man for another term. So he was, the convention was taking place in Chicago. He led on the first 6-7 ballots. But he had an engagement to speak in Milwaukee.
Oh, my.
And he was very close to winning. And Julia said, if you will just go to the convention floor, you will get the nomination. And she said, I cannot do that. I cannot do that. I cannot put myself forward in that way. I have an engagement to
speak
groups in Wisconsin. And so he didn't go to the convention floor. This was so much like him, and he traveled on to Wisconsin and gave, as you say correctly, Keith, one of his, not that he was a great public speaker, but he was so, again, self-effacing and giving credit to other people. Let me just give you one quick anecdote. He was celebrating July 4th in 1878 in Hamburg, Germany. It was his world tour, and the consul for the United States lifted a toast to the general who won the Civil War, and Grant interrupted him and said, if I may, I did not win the Civil War. He said, the young men who came from their farms and villages and towns, they won the Civil War. All I did was help direct and coordinate their efforts. If you want to toast anybody, please toast these young men. Isn't that just remarkable?
That kind of humility is wonderful. Perhaps a lost quality.
It's a lost quality, yeah.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Dan in Shorewood. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Kathleen. Wonderful show. Thank you so much.
Sure.
I'd just like the author to comment on the fact that Ulysses' real first name, his given first name is Hiram, and his middle name was Ulysses, and how he didn't like to use the name of, or go by that, his initials spelled Hug, and as a young man, how that was kind of embarrassing, and how it got to be that his name ultimately wound up as Ulysses S. Grant.
Yeah, it was Sam for a while, too, wasn't it? You have a whole part of the book on that.
Yeah, right. Dan, that's a good question, yes. They had a naming contest. People did that in the 19th century. They didn't name this baby until 6 weeks after his birth, and they named him Hiram Ulysses. But you're correct, as he was getting ready to go to West Point, a man who made a trunk for him put on initials on the trunk, Hug, H-U-G, and he thought, oh, my goodness, I'll be teased for that.
Yeah.
So he got to West Point and introduced himself as Hiram Ulysses Grant. And the fellow who was the registrar said, oh, we don't have anybody by that name. Well, he said, that's my name. Well, he said, you're not going to register unless you go by the name that we have. He said, what's that name? The name is Ulysses Simpson Grant. Well, the congressman who had nominated him, it was getting late in the process. He couldn't remember his middle name. And so his mother's maiden name was Simpson. So he said, it's Ulysses Simpson Grant. So that's where we get the U.S. Grant. But as Kathleen has said, at West Point, he was often called Sam because when the boys there saw U.S. Grant, they teased him and said, Uncle Sam has arrived.
Wow.
Uncle Sam has arrived. And he became Sam at West Point.
Let's hear some of the compliments about him. Frederick Douglass, these are at the end of your book, the foremost, of course, African-American leader of the 19th century. To him, this is incredible praise from Frederick Douglass. To him, more than any other man, the Negro owns his enfranchisement and the Indian a humane policy. He was accessible to all men. The black soldier was welcome in his tent and the freed man in his house.
Isn't that remarkable?
It really is.
Correct. This is the most, this is the leading African-American figure of the 19th century saying these words about Grant.
Quite something, and others have said. I thought I read somewhere a comment from him that he couldn't wait to get out of the White House. Did he dislike being president?
Well, I don't think he disliked being president, but I mean, after 8 years, this would wear upon you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he had dreamed of this trip abroad. He loved to travel. Julia wanted to stay in the White House. I think she would have wished he would have run for a third term right then. But it wasn't that he disliked it, but this chapter was over. He's ready for the next chapter.
Yeah. Well, you got the Civil War, for heaven's sake. You got the White House. That's a lot. That's a lot to do. Yeah. Aren't you glad you wrote a book about him? I sure am.
I am. You know, I had no idea when I started this project what it would become and who I would discover. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much. It's a wonderful book, and I'll read your Abraham Lincoln books, I promise.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. Your interest in and knowledge of American history, it's a privilege to be on your show.
Oh, thank you, Ronald. I appreciate that. Ronald White, his book is American Ulysses, A Life of Ulysses S. Grant, and he is a Lincoln scholar. Some of you probably have read the bestseller A Lincoln, which is his most recent. He has lectured on Lincoln at universities all over. He's lectured at Gettysburg, at the White House, and he's a wonderful historian. Well, that does it for this hour. Thanks so much to Colleen Leahy for producing this program, and to Colleen as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll be with you tomorrow. We're going to talk about North Korea, the first hour of our program tomorrow, and all that just saying those two words or that country's name entails. And then the minimum wage will be second hour of conversation. Thanks for listening. News is coming up momentarily and in Central Time, so enjoy the afternoon until tomorrow.